Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozworski, and welcome to the show. Today, the focus will be on the role of government in the economy with guests from the nation's top progressive economic think tanks. I'll be speaking about Jim Flaherty's legacy as federal finance minister and the Quebec economy in the context of that province's election campaign. First up, my guest to talk about Jim Flaherty is Armin Yalnızyan. Armin is a senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. She's also a founding member of the Globe and Mail's Economy Lab feature and of the Progressive Economics Forum blog, on which I'm also sometimes an author. Here is my conversation with Armin. Hi, Armin. It's great that you could join me today.
Thank you, Michal.
Right, so let's get into it. You know, as many of our listeners know, Jim Flaherty recently resigned as federal finance minister, and he'd held the post for 8 years. In fact, he was Stephen Harper's only finance minister. And you recently wrote a piece on Flaherty's legacy. And we saw many opinion pieces describing this legacy as prudent, as sort of providing a steady hand on the tiller of Canada's economy. And I think you questioned some of these in your piece, describing parts of his legacy as ideological, reckless, lucky. These are some of the words you use, and trying to give a whole picture that doesn't just focus on this one soundbite of prudence that we've seen in the media. So why don't we go through some of these other adjectives that you've used to describe Flaherty's legacy one at a time, and starting from maybe from the end, and with this idea of luck. So what are some of the local and global trends that smiled down on Jim Flaherty during his tenure as finance minister?
Yeah, I thank you very much for your question and for drilling down into this a little bit. It's always difficult to measure a finance minister's legacy for a whole host of reasons, not least of which because so much is out of your control. Out of your control because of domestic differences, and in particular for Canada, global realities when it comes to the global supply chain, of which we are such an integrated part of right now. So Canada did really luck out. Right through 2008, 2009, 2010, China was growing at double-digit rates of growth. And increasingly, China was certainly not the only part of the global supply chain that we were feeding, but a really important part of the emerging markets that were feeding off of one another's energy and growth despite the global crisis, because we were feeding them resources. And our commodity sector took a beating in Alberta. But many parts of Canada, you could have been excused to say, crisis, what crisis? I'm thinking about Saskatchewan. I'm thinking about the territories. I'm thinking about almost everywhere in the north of the country where ores and potash, minerals, precious metals were being pulled out of the ground. Oil did take a beating because of the United States, but anybody that was supplying raw materials to the global supply chain was doing pretty good. And because our commodity sector really kept chugging away through this period, we bounced back out of the global recession more rapidly than any of our G7 partners, because none of our other G7 partners were feeding the global supply chain. So that was just luck. And there was another element of luck, which was more Canadian, made in Canada, which was the fact that Mr. Flaherty had inherited an $18 billion surplus in his first budget, which they did their best to get rid of. They introduced the 2% GST cut, which is today worth $14 billion, and a host of other tax cuts because they campaigned on a smaller federal presence. They made good on that right from their first budget. Consequently, by the time we got to 2008, in November of 2008, when they gave the update on how is the economy doing as this global economic crisis is falling apart, both the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister said, we won't go into a deficit because we've already stimulated the economy with these tax cuts we put into place. In fact, they brought in over $200 billion worth of tax cuts in their first 23 months in power. And they assumed that that would be enough to propel our economy out of any crisis that happened. So, the luck that they had in having a fat surplus to whittle away at is no small reason why the deficit didn't bite sooner, but in fact, their tax cuts made the deficit hole ultimately much larger than it needed to be.
Right. I think that's part of that. That's exactly part of it. I want to ask you maybe if you could elaborate a bit on exactly that, on Flaherty's response within this fortuitous context as he went forward from 2006, 2008, and what are some of the examples of the recklessness that you're accusing Flaherty of?
Well, okay, so I mentioned the tax cuts, which are not reckless in the sense that they're ideological. They were a plan, and they did it, and there was a reckless piece of it, but I'll get to that in a minute. First of all, the most reckless thing that they did was something that they did by June of 2006. This is within months of taking power. And they gave the green light to the zero-down 40-year mortgage policy that was so devastating in the United States. They permitted AIG and Genworth, private sector mortgage insurers from the United States. You'll remember AIG was one of the first companies to go belly up in the 2008 debacle. They opened the floodgates to this type of financing. And, you know, you've heard frequently it's said that Mr. Flaherty was so pragmatic in the way he reined in, you know, and fearless in reining in the mortgage market. He stepped in four times to discipline them, it's been said repeatedly. It was his office that created that problem in the first place. You know, when they watched what happened in the United States, when they watched the explosive growth of zero-down 40-year mortgages, about 70% of all mortgages issued in the wake of that decision were of that caliber. And, you know, at some point, you're going to start hitting people that should not be taking out mortgages. And so they had to roll back on that decision. And if you consider that pragmatic, great. But, like, why do that in the first place? That's what I mean by there was a certain recklessness. Secondly, in terms of their tax cuts, there were some really big ones. One of the biggest ones was the tax-free savings account that was brought into play in, wait for it, January of 2009. The conservative commitment to tax cuts did not hiccup, did not miss a heartbeat. Every single tax cut they announced went through as planned, irrespective of a global crisis. At a time when you wanted more purchasing power, however, they introduced this tax-free savings account, which pulls money out of the system. You know, the world is crying out for more purchasing power, and they're encouraging people to suck money out of the system. That's just reckless. And in fact, there's an analysis that's done that shows that when this particular tax shelter kicks into full gear in about another 10 years, it's estimated to cost the public purse about $10 billion. The Canadian Chartered General Accountants called it revolutionary. It was rejected in the United States three times. Bush tried to bring it in three times from 2005 to 2007, and Congress rejected it because it benefited the rich too much. So we got it passed through in a blink of an eye in the middle of a freaking crisis, and it is a revolutionary piece of tax legislation that changes the architecture of the way we spend and save, and also will permanently, structurally undermine the public purse going down the road. I see that as reckless.
Right. I think there's a link there as well to the ideology piece, and it's one that you've already spoken about, I think, mentioning that, you know, these are structural changes that are being made. So maybe you could very quickly talk us through sort of what is the mark of ideology on Flaherty's legacy, and what are some of these lasting sort of more structural changes to Canada's public finances that you think he was trying to put in place?
Well, I think there are two issues here. The first one is that people that think that this is a government that campaigned for small government but raised expenditures did not meet their commitment to small government. But I would point to the role of the federal government as a share of the economy, which after the crisis is pointed to be at the lowest level it has been since the 1940s, the late 1940s, and that happened by accident, by the way. The incredibly small role of the federal government in relationship to the entire economy happened by accident in the late 1940s because of post-war mobilization, like the putting the whole apparatus of the war machine into consumer goods, and the economy grew faster than expected. And consequently, government spending for two or three fiscal years was smaller than anything we'd seen since the 1920s. Well, we're now heading that to that very same level now by design. That is the goal of fiscal budgets. You look at them year after year. This was the plan before 2008, and it has been the plan since 2010, is to bring us down to about 12.5% of GDP as a share of the economy. And so that's the smallest federal presence in the economy we've seen in over a generation. And now we've got healthcare, we've got post-secondary, a massive post-secondary network. We've got all sorts of things that we didn't used to have in the late 1940s. So that's point number one, is the ideology is for small government. They have and will deliver small government when you compare it to the size of the Canadian economy. The second point is about fiscal federalism. And this is a party that campaigned on a return to the 1867 British North America Act division of responsibilities between the federal and the provincial jurisdictions. This is something that they want to head back to. And in the process of so doing, they are introducing a new form of fiscal federalism, which in my view is leading to greater balkanization, less emphasis on equalization, so that you get the same, you are guaranteed through federal policies, roughly the same equivalencies of citizenship no matter where you live in the country when it comes to public services. And much more pitting provinces against one another, less support for very important fundamentals like access to healthcare and post-secondary education, and less investment in infrastructure that binds and grows the economy together. We did infrastructure as a stimulus exercise. We have a mountain of infrastructure deficit that our municipalities are coping with across the country, and no plan to deal with it across the country. In addition to which, we've got a federal government that has opened the floodgates to temporary foreign workers, but done nothing about housing or transportation policy. So we let in about a million people in 2012. They're going to go and live somewhere, and mostly they are living in large urban centers where there's already affordable housing crises and transportation crises. This is a government that loves to keep its hands off the wheel, but it keeps driving home policies that make it much harder to steer towards a successful economic future for everyone.
Right. So we only have maybe about 30 seconds left, but speaking of a successful economic future, as you already mentioned, you're involved in the policy alternatives, alternative budget process. So maybe you could just give me two or three ideas from this year's alternative budget that you think would have the biggest impact on reversing some of the most damaging aspects of this conservative legacy in finance.
Well, this year, the alternative federal budget put a focus on income inequality. Do we know how the measures we bring into play affect equality, both regional equality, intergenerational inequality, as well as income inequality? And we have kind of road tested all of the policies we put in there with a view to improving equality in Canada. So I think that's the type of, you know, litmus test for any public policy these days from the federal government. Are you improving the degree of equality or reducing inequality, or are you making it worse? And that would be my number one acid test for anything you do. And secondarily, I suppose, would be a commitment to improving the foundation of the economy for both individuals, for families, for communities, as well as businesses. We need a commitment to improve the infrastructure, both human and physical, in all of our communities across this country. That's what a federal government is for. That's what I hope a federal government in the future will commit itself to.
All right. Thanks so much for joining me again. Would be nice to hear that from Finance Minister every once in a while. Thank you, Armin.
Yeah, I wouldn't want the job. Thank you, Michal.
Thanks. That was Armin Yalnızyan, Senior Economist with the CCPA. For more from Armin, you can follow her on Twitter. My next guest is Evelyn Couturier, a researcher with the Institut de Recherche et d'Information Socio-Économique, or IRIS. IRIS is a Quebec-based nonprofit, independent, and progressive research institute established in the year 2000. Since then, it has been a strong voice for progressive economic policy in that province and a counterbalance to the dogmas pushed by politicians and sections of the corporate media. Here is Evelyn Couturier on the Quebec economy. So hello, Evelyn, and thanks for joining me in these busy days not far off from a provincial election in Quebec.
My pleasure.
So before maybe we get to the specifics of the current election campaign, I want to ask you a more general question. I know Quebec has long been regarded as a sort of outlier in Canada. particularly because of its stronger welfare state. For the right, of course, the province is seen as an overregulated underachiever. For the left, however, it's often been represented as a kind of aspirational model, a model for change, possible change in Anglophone Canada, thinking, for example, of the universal childcare program or other progressive policies that you have in place. So maybe in light of this, what do you see as some of the most salient economic trends in Quebec at the moment? And is it still fair to talk about its uniqueness when compared to the rest of Canada?
Well, what's a little bit strange with Quebec is that on the one hand, we really want to have some public services that are really strong and that are different from the rest of Canada. So we always try to, when there's a federal program, to find a way to put it, to tailor it to our province. But at the same time, we're a bit obsessed with the average, the Canadian average and Ontario. So we see the two dynamics at the same time. One, trying to be unique, trying to have our own model of things. And the other one, trying to compare ourselves to other province, other jurisdiction, and trying to limit these special trends that we have. So I think that in Quebec, we're really proud of our child care program and also our parental leave that we have. Is fairly long, and it's obligatory. It's mandatory for the dad to take a leave also. So that's something that we're very proud of. But at the same time, when we look at how much we spend money on childcare and on parental leave and such, we start to say, well, we're spending much more and too much compared to elsewhere. And in that example is you can take that example and put it in other fields also. So we're having this obsession on productivity, on the need of more a different kind of management in public services, and that is changing the way that the services are provided and also the services are taught about. So let's say in healthcare, we're talking more and more of putting more private in healthcare because it costs too much. Trying to find ways to reduce costs, not thinking at how we can have better services, but how our services could be less costly.
That's interesting. So it's a kind of, it's a dynamic going in the other direction now as well. And perhaps we can talk about that in the context of what's happening right now, too. So there is a provincial election that's barely a week and a half away. And I mean, economic issues have taken a bit of a backseat. We've had discussions about sovereignty and the charter of values that have really been in the foreground. But I think the economy is always there in the background of any election campaign. And I was just talking about Jim Flaherty's legacy with Armin Yalnizian. And what would you say is the economic legacy of the last PQ government as it goes into this election? A legacy, that we should remember was associated a bit with some hope flowing from the Maple Spring.
Well, at the beginning of the government of the PQ, we saw some changes that we thought, well, the left, the progressive movement thought that was positive. And let's talk about, I don't know how you say it in English, but amiante. So the it's a mineral that is very dangerous for the health, and we have a lot of that in Quebec, and we were doing a lot of exports.
And yes. Yeah.
And we did a ban on that. So that was positive. And we were thinking that we were going to see a shift in the way that the mining industry would be regulated. And there was a ban on schist gas. So some things were really positive, but very quickly things changed. And we saw that the political agenda of the PQ was quite similar of the political agenda of the Liberal Party. And they're also obsessed with the natural resource exploitation. We're talking about gas and petrol, mostly oil and petrol. Oil and gas, but also in the mining sector. The reform that they were passing, we thought it would be more progressive. But at the end of the year, when we look at how much money we have and how much regulated the mining industry is, there's not a big difference than what we had with the PLQ before. So it's not really, we don't see that big of a change. The discourse is a little bit different because they're trying also to distance themselves from the Canada government. But besides that, it's still pretty the same. And in the election, what is funny is that we had a debate last week, and the debate was when we were talking about the economic question, it was centered about how much job were created, and the three major parties were also only trying to find which statistic was the good statistic, because we have two competing statistics. We have a full-time job that is we're losing some full-time jobs, but we're creating much more part-time jobs. So on the one hand, if you look at the global statistic, you see a increase in job creation because there's more part-time jobs. But if you look at the specific full-time job, there's a backlash, there's less jobs. So the debate was only centered on that. We're not talking about concrete job creating. We're not talking about what kind of economic prosperity we want for Quebec. We're not talking about should we try to invest in more green jobs or should we try to invest in more public sector. We're just talking about which statistic is the good one. And I feel that for this election, almost all debates on every subject is of the same nature. We're not talking about the issue of the concrete real issues. We're talking about how we should talk about the issue. So it's a bit deceiving.
Right, that does sound a bit difficult. So maybe you could go into that. Maybe you could say a bit about what you think the economic issues perhaps should be, the ones that aren't being talked about, and what kinds of economic policies you see are sort of necessary for Quebec, and maybe also touching on if anyone on the political scene is talking about any of this.
Well, one major issue and one major issue on which it is works a lot these days is the environment question. We're seeing more and more reports and analysis from experts saying that we are in a big crisis, and it's not going to it's getting worse and worse as we speak. And we're not talking about that in this election. And when we're talking about environment and job creation, we're talking about how to maximize the job creation in the environment, saying that we will do our best not to have a big impact on the environment, but not thinking it through to find a way to put environment at the forefront of the conversation. So at AGIS, we think that this is a priority, that if we're talking about job creation, we have to think about a sustainable job creation, how we can manage to have prosperity in our province, but also a prosperity that is on the long term, and not only for us, but also for our children and our children's children, and to have this planet the longest possible.
Thank you so much. Definitely a debate that could be used not only in Quebec, but other parts of Canada as well. That's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining me, Evelyn.
No problem.
And a pleasure to talk to you. That was Evelyn Couturier, researcher with AGIS in Quebec. That's it for this week. I hope you'll join me next time.